and thank you for tuning in to Bricada Circle, your tribe of storytellers for nonprofit organizations. We are broadcasting on Party 93.4. Barkada is a word in the Filipino language that means best friends. Barkada Circle is a community of artists who are passionate about helping nonprofit organizations tell their stories in more compelling ways to engage people into becoming active supporters, volunteers, and donors who want to create real positive impact in their communities. I'm Parangara, your main mixologist for Barkada Circle, and on this 4th of July celebration, the American holiday of all American holidays, I'd like to introduce you to the music of Rolf Nagenfeind. Rolf describes his music as embodying the spirit of Americana with roots in the blues. A native of North Carolina, Rolf recently found his home in my neighborhood called Rogers Park in Chicago. I'll be playing songs from his latest album entitled Chicago, now available on iTunes. Let's first listen to We Can Run by Rolf Nagenfeind.
Hold me now, tell me now, every secret that you left out. Let me know, or let me go far from here. Let me find a peace of mind. Let me see the lights of Vegas. Let me drive far behind the setting sun. There's a road I might take, just another mistake. If it's wrong, at least I'll know where I come from. And I don't know what it's like to leave the ground in flight, but I know if I try, stars from your sky. And I don't mind if you drive, as long as we get there. There's no place I'd rather be than with you. We can run far away from here. We'll drive until the morning. Let go. Every secret that you left out, we can run far away from here. We'll drive until the morning. Let go of our fears. We can stay in each other's arms. Find a new tomorrow with the right. We can run
And that was Rolf Nagenfein with his song Rearview Mirror. And before that, you heard We Can Run. Rolf Nagenfein's CD is available on iTunes. This is Parangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. You can listen to a podcast of this program and broadcasts of other artists on this station by going to party934.com and clicking on the podcast page. I'd also like to invite you to check out my blog on barkatacircle.com, where I talk about storytelling for nonprofits, fundraising, and how to grow your organization's impact and value for the community. Once again, happy 4th of July to all of you out there. In my community of Rogers Park in Chicago, we've got cool summer weather, perfect for enjoying the outdoors, and some great grilling. For the entire country, it's a time to celebrate our victories as a nation, to celebrate our freedom, and to express our patriotism. But what does this all mean? What is freedom in today's context? What does it mean to be an American, to value our liberties, and to at the same time recognize that others share that same freedom with us? Today we will hear stories that reveal the truth about the men and the women who fight for our country's freedom. Not romanticized, not idealized. It's what most of us don't see, or don't know about, or sometimes even choose to ignore. Wes Moore grew up in Maryland in the early 80s, and after his father passed away when he was 3 years old, he started acting up. Eventually, at age 13, his mother sent him away to military school. This turned out to be a life-changing experience. He adjusted well to the rigid order and took off academically, going on to study international relations at Oxford University on a Rhodes Scholarship. Wes Moore joined the U.S. Army to pay for college, but the experience became core to who he is today. In this heartfelt talk, the paratrooper and captain explains the shock of returning home from Afghanistan. He shares the single phrase he heard from civilians on repeat and shows why it's just not sufficient. It's a call for all of us to ask veterans to tell their stories and for us to listen. Let's listen to Wes Moore.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features veteran and writer Wes Moore. This talk contains powerful visuals. Download the video at TED.com. Here's Wes Moore.
I'm excited to be here to speak about vets because I didn't join the Army because I wanted to go to war. I didn't join the Army because I had a lust or a need to go overseas and fight. Frankly, I joined the Army because college is really damn expensive and they were going to help with that. And I joined the Army because it was what I knew. And it was what I knew that I thought I could do well. I didn't come from a military family. I'm not a military brat. No one in my family ever had joined the military at all. And how I first got introduced to the military was when I was 13 years old and I got sent away to military school. Because my mother had been threatening me with this idea of military school ever since I was 8 years old. I had some issues when I was coming up. And my mother would always tell me, she's like, you know, if you don't get this together, I'm gonna send you to military school. And I'd look at her and I'd say, Mommy, I'll work harder. And then when I was 9 years old, she started giving me brochures to show me she wasn't playing around. So I'd look at the brochures and I'd be like, okay, Mommy, I can see you're serious and I'll work harder. And then when I was 10 and 11, my behavior just kept on getting worse. I was on academic and disciplinary probation by the time before I even hit single digits or double digits. And I first felt handcuffs on my wrists when I was 11 years old. And so when I was 13 years old, my mother came up to me and she was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to send you to military school. And I looked at her and I said, Mommy, I can see you're upset and I'm going to work harder. And she's like, no, you're going next week. And that was how I first got introduced to this whole idea of the military, because she thought this was a good idea. I had to disagree with her wholeheartedly when I first showed up there, because literally in the first 4 days, I had already run away 5 times from this school. They had these big black gates that surrounded the school. And every time they would turn their backs, I would just simply run out of the black gates and take them up on their offer that if we didn't want to be there, we could leave at any time. So I just said, well, if that's the case, then I'd like to leave. And it never worked. And I kept on getting lost. But then eventually, after staying there for a little while, and after the end of that first year at this military school, I realized that I actually was growing up. I realized the things that I enjoyed about this school and the thing that I enjoyed about the structure was something that I never found before. The fact that I finally felt like I was part of something bigger and part of a team and it actually mattered to people that I was there. the fact that leadership wasn't just a punchline there, but that it was a real, actually core part of the entire experience. And so when it was time for me to actually finish up high school, I started thinking about what I wanted to do. And just like probably most students, had no idea what that meant or what I wanted to do. And I thought about the people who I respected and admired. I thought about a lot of the people, and particularly about a lot of the men in my life who I looked up to. They all happened to wear the uniform of the United States of America. So for me, the question and the answer really became pretty easy. The question of what I wanted to do was filled in very quickly with saying, I guess I'll be an Army officer. So the Army then went through this process and they trained me up. And when I say I didn't join the Army because I wanted to go to war, the truth is I joined in 1996. There really wasn't a whole lot going on. I didn't ever feel like I was in danger. When I went to my mom, I first joined the Army when I was 17 years old, so I literally needed parental permission to join the Army. So I kind of gave the paperwork to my mom and she just assumed it was kind of like military school. She's like, well, it was good for him before, so I guess I'll just let him keep doing it. Having no idea that the paperwork that she was signing was actually signing her son up to become an Army officer. And I went through the process, and again, the whole time still just thinking this is great, maybe I'll serve on a weekend or 2 weeks during the year, do drill. And then a couple years after I signed up, a couple years after my mother signed those papers, the whole world changed. And after 9/11, there was an entirely new context about the occupation that I chose. When I first joined, I never joined to fight. But now that I was in, this is exactly what was now going to happen. And I thought about so much about the soldiers who I eventually had to end up leading. I remember when we first, you know, right after 9/11, 3 weeks after 9/11, I was on a plane heading overseas, but I wasn't heading overseas with the military. I was heading overseas because I got a scholarship to go overseas. I received, you know, the scholarship to go overseas and to go study and live overseas. And I was living in England and that was interesting. But at the same time, the same people who I was training with, the same soldiers that I went through all my training with and we prepared for war, they were now actually heading over to it. They were now about to find themselves in the middle of places that, fact is, the vast majority of people, the vast majority of us, as we were training, couldn't even point out on a map. I spent a couple years finishing graduate school, and the whole entire time while I'm sitting there in buildings in Oxford that were literally built hundreds of years before the United States was even founded, and I'm sitting there talking to dons about the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and how that influenced the start of the World War I, where the entire time my heart and my head were on my soldiers who are now throwing on Kevlars and grabbing their flak vests and figuring out how exactly do I change a round or how exactly do I clean a machine gun in the darkness. That was the new reality. By the time I finished that up and I rejoined my military unit and we were getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan, there were soldiers in my unit who were now on their second and third deployments before I even had my first. I remember walking out with my unit for the first time, and when you join the Army and you go through a combat tour, you have everyone looks at your shoulder, because on your shoulder is your combat patch. And so immediately as you meet people, you shake their hand and then your eyes go to their shoulder because you want to see where did they serve or what unit did they serve with. And I was the only person walking around with a bare shoulder. And it burned every time someone stared at it. But you get a chance to talk to your soldiers. And you ask them, why did they sign up? I signed up because college was expensive. A lot of my soldiers signed up for completely different reasons. They signed up because of a sense of obligation. They signed up because they were angry and they wanted to do something about it. They signed up because their family said this was important. They signed up because they wanted some form of revenge. They signed up for a whole collection of different reasons. And now we all found ourselves overseas fighting in these conflicts. And what was amazing to me was that I very naively started hearing this statement that I never fully understood. Because right after 9/11, you start hearing this idea where people come up to you and they say, well, thank you for your service. And I just kind of followed in and started saying the same things to all my soldiers. This is even before I deployed. but I really had no idea what that even meant. I just said it because it sounded right. I said it because it sounded like the right thing to say to people who had served overseas, thank you for your service. But I had no idea what the context was or what it even meant to the people who heard it. When I first came back from Afghanistan, I thought that if you make it back from conflict, then the dangers were all over. I thought that if you made it back from a conflict zone, that somehow you could kind of wipe the sweat off your brow and say, I'm glad I dodged that one. Without understanding that for so many people, as they come back home, the war keeps going. It keeps playing out in all of our minds. It plays out in all of our memories. It plays out in all of our emotions. Please forgive us if we don't like being in big crowds. Please forgive us when we spend 1 week in a place that has 100% light discipline, because you're not allowed to walk around with white lights, because if anything has a white light, it can be seen from miles away, versus if you use little green or little blue lights, they cannot be seen from far away. So please forgive us if out of nowhere we go from having 100% light discipline to then a week later being back in the middle of Times Square and we have a difficult time adjusting to that. Please forgive us when you transition back to a family who has completely been maneuvering without you. And now when you come back, it's not that easy to fall back into a sense of normality, because the whole normal has changed. I remember when I came back, I wanted to talk to people. I wanted people to ask me about my experiences. I wanted people to come up to me and tell me, what did you do? I wanted people to come up to me and tell me, what was it like? What was the food like? What was the experience like? How are you doing? And the only questions I got from people was, did you shoot anybody? And those were the ones who were even curious enough to say anything. Because sometimes there's this fear and there's this apprehension that if I say anything, I'm afraid I'll offend or I'm afraid I'll trigger something. So the common default is just say nothing. The problem with that is then it feels like your service was not even acknowledged. Like no one even cared. Thank you for your service. And we move on. What I wanted to better understand was what's behind that, and why thank you for your service isn't enough. The fact is we have literally 2.6 million men and women who are veterans of Iraq or Afghanistan who are all amongst us. Sometimes we know who they are, sometimes we don't. But there is that feeling, this shared experience, this shared bond, where we know that that experience in that chapter of our life, while it might be closed, it's still not over. When we think about thank you for your service, and people say, so what does thank you for your service mean to you? Well, thank you for your service means to me, it means acknowledging our stories, asking us who we are, understanding the strength that so many people who we serve with have, and why that service means so much. Thank you for your service means acknowledging the fact that just because we've now come home and we've taken off a uniform does not mean our larger service to this country is somehow over. The fact is there's still a tremendous amount that can be offered and can be given. When I look at people like our friend Taylor Urella, who in Iraq loses his leg, had two big dreams in his life. One was to be a soldier, the other was to be a baseball player. He loses his leg in Iraq. He comes back, and instead of deciding that, now since I've lost my leg, that second dream is over, he decides that he still has that dream of playing baseball, and he starts his group called Vet Sports, which now works with veterans all over the country and uses sports as a way of healing. People like Tammy Duckworth, who's a helicopter pilot, and with a helicopter that she was flying, you need to use both your hands and also your legs to steer, and her helicopter gets hit, and she's trying to steer the chopper, but the chopper's not reacting to her instructions and to her commands. She's trying to land the chopper safely, but the chopper doesn't land safely. And the reason it's not landing safely is because it's not responding to the commands that her legs are giving, because her legs were blown off. She barely survives. Medics come and they save her life. But then as she's doing her recuperation back at home, she realizes that my job's still not done. And now she uses her voice as a congresswoman from Illinois to fight and advocate for a collection of issues to include veterans' issues. We signed up because we love this country we represent. We signed up because we believe in the idea, and we believe to the people to our left and to our right. And the only thing we then ask is that thank you for your service needs to be more than just a quote break. That thank you for your service means honestly digging in to the people who've stepped up simply because they were asked to. And what that means for us, not just now, not just during combat operations, but long after the last vehicle has left and after the last shot has been taken. These are the people who I served with. And these are the people who I honor. So thank you for your service.
That was Wes Moore, recorded at TED in January 2014. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4.
It's 9 o'clock when the rain set in. I just sat there feeling the same as those countless lonely nights. Tore the seal from the bottle again, poured a double shot of my old friend, and dug in for a fight. I've been holding on to this for far too long. Never thought I'd see you again, out of sight, out of mind, till you walked into the room, acting like we was just old friends. Tried to greet me with a Judas kiss, or you were standing there with him. I wish I was more like you, could erase you from my mind. It's been playing over. Well, I'd walk through the cold rain, give you my last name if you'd see. I'd stand on your front lawn, sing you a love song, words so sweet. And I'd wait up by the phone for your call. That ain't all. If I could lasso the moon, I'd pull it down for you. Before the night is over, I'll need a wish from you. Well, I'd do all the small things, put my old ring on yours. And I'd buy the finest flowers, spend all my hours to be your man. And I'd come running every single time you call to break your fall. If I could lasso the moon, I'd pull it down for you. Before the night over, I'll need a wish from you. I'm trying to understand is how to be your man. So tell me what to do. Show my love is true. If I could lasso the moon, I'd pull it down for you. Before the night is over,
was Lasso the Moon by Rolf Nagenfeind. And before that, you heard his song entitled There in Your Arms. This is Parangara, and you're listening to Barcata Circle on Party 93.4. Thank you once again for listening to today's program. You can follow us on twitter.com/party93.4 and facebook.com/party93.4. Before the break, we heard Wes Moore tell us how soldiers coming home from war need to tell their stories in order to feel that risking their lives for the freedom of our country actually matters to the rest of us. It mattered a great deal to them on the battlefield, and they greatly mattered to each other. The bond that forms between comrades in war is a bond that is like no other. Sebastian Younger is all too familiar with this. A correspondent for Vanity Fair and ABC News, Younger has covered stories all across the globe, igniting a new interest in nonfiction. One of his main interests is war. From 2007 to 2008, Younger and photographer Tim Hetherington embedded with the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team in Afghanistan. They spent intensive time with the soldiers at the Restrepo outpost in the Korangal Valley, which saw more combat than any other part of Afghanistan. The experience became Younger's book entitled War and the documentary entitled Restrepo, which was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2011. Civilians don't miss war, but soldiers often do. In his TED Talk in 2014, journalist Sebastian Younger shares his experience in Afghanistan. Giving a look at the altered state of mind that comes with war, he shows how combat gives soldiers an intense experience of connection. In the end, could it actually be the opposite of war that soldiers miss? Let's listen to Sebastian Younger.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features war reporter Sebastian Younger. This talk contains powerful visuals. Download the video at TED.com. Here's Sebastian Younger.
I'm going to ask and try to answer a, some ways, kind of an uncomfortable question. Both civilians, obviously, and soldiers suffer in war. I don't think any civilian has ever missed the war that they were subjected to. And I've been covering wars for almost 20 years, and one of the remarkable things for me is how many soldiers find themselves missing it. How is it someone can go through the worst experience imaginable and come home, back to their home and their family, their country, and miss the war? How does that work? What's it mean? We have to answer that question, because if we don't, it'll be impossible to bring soldiers back to the to a place in society where they belong. And I think it'll also be impossible to stop war if we don't understand how that mechanism works. The problem is that war does not have a simple, neat truth, one simple, neat truth. Any sane person hates war, hates the idea of war, wouldn't want to have anything to do with it, doesn't want to be near it, doesn't want to know about it. That's a sane response to war. But if I asked all of you in this room, who here has paid money to go to a cinema and be entertained by a Hollywood war movie, most of you would probably raise your hands. That's what's so complicated about war. And trust me, if a room full of peace-loving people find something compelling about war, so do 20-year-old soldiers who have been trained in it. I promise you. That's the thing that has to be understood. I've covered war for about 20 years, as I said, but my most intense experiences in combat were with American soldiers in Afghanistan. I'd been in Africa, in the Middle East, Afghanistan in the 90s, but it was with American soldiers in 2007, 2008, that I was confronted with very intense combat. I was in a small valley called the Korangal Valley in eastern Afghanistan. It was 6 miles long. There were 150 men of battle company in that valley. And for a while I was there, almost 20% of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening in those 6 miles. 150 men were absorbing almost a fifth of the combat for all of NATO forces in the country for a couple months. It was very intense. I spent most of my time at a small outpost called Restrepo. It was named after the platoon medic that had been killed about 2 months into the deployment. It was a few plywood bee huts clinging to the side of a ridge, and sandbags, bunkers, gun positions. There were 20 men up there of 2nd Platoon Battle Company. I spent most of my time up there. There was no running water. There was no way to bathe. The guys were up there for a month at a time. They never even got out of their clothes. They fought, they worked, they slept in the same clothes. They never took them off. And at the end of the month, they went back down to the company headquarters. And by then, their clothes were unwearable. They burned them and got a new set. There was no internet. There was no phone. There was no communication with the outside world up there. There was no cooked food. There was nothing up there that young men typically like. No cars, no girls, no television, nothing. except combat. Combat, they did learn to like. I remember one day, it was a very hot day in the spring, and we hadn't been in a fight in a couple of weeks, maybe. Usually the outpost was attacked, and we hadn't seen any combat in a couple of weeks, and everyone was just stunned with boredom and heat. And I remember the lieutenant walking past me, sort of stripped to the waist. It was incredibly hot, stripped to the waist, walked past me muttering, "Oh God, please someone attack us today." That's how bored they were. That's war too. It's a lieutenant saying, "Please something, make something happen, because we're going crazy." To understand that, you have to, for a moment, think about combat not morally. That's an important job to do. But for a moment, don't think about it morally. Think about it neurologically. Let's think about what happens in your brain when you're in combat. First of all, the experience is, it's a very bizarre, one. It's not what I had expected. Usually you're not scared. I've been very scared in combat. But most of the time when I was out there, I wasn't scared. I was very scared beforehand and incredibly scared afterwards. And that fear that comes afterwards can last years. I haven't been shot at in 6 years. And I was woken up very abruptly this morning by a nightmare that I was being strafed by aircraft 6 years later. I've never even been strafed by aircraft, and I was having nightmares about it. Time slows down. You get this weird tunnel vision. You notice some details very, very, very accurately, and other things drop out. It's almost a slightly altered state of mind. What's happening in your brain is you're getting an enormous amount of adrenaline pumped through your system. Young men will go to great lengths to have that experience. It's wired into us. It's hormonally supported. The mortality rate for young men in society is 6 times what it is for young women from violence and from accidents, just the stupid stuff that young men do, jumping off of things they shouldn't jump off of, lighting things on fire they shouldn't light on fire. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. They die at 6 times the rate that young women do. Statistically, you are safer as a teenage boy. You are safe. You would be safer in the fire department or the police department in most American cities than just walking around the streets of your hometown looking for something to do. Statistically. You can imagine how that plays out in combat. At Restrepo, every guy up there was almost killed, including me, including my good friend Tim Hetherington, who was later killed in Libya. There were guys walking around with bullet holes in their uniforms, rounds that had cut through the fabric and didn't touch their bodies. I was leaning against some sandbags one morning, not much going on, sort of spacing out, and some sand was kicked into the side of my, some sort of hit the side of my face. Something hit the side of my face. I didn't know what it was. You have to understand about bullets that they go a lot faster than sound. So if someone shoots at you from a few hundred meters, the bullet goes by you, or hits you, obviously, half a second or so before the sound catches up to it. So I got some sand sprayed in the side of my face. Half a second later, I heard, da-da-da-da-da. It was a machine gun fire. It was the first round, first burst of an hour-long firefight. What had happened was a bullet hit 3 or 4 inches from the side of my head. Imagine, just think about it, because I certainly did. Think about the angle of deviation that saved my life. At 400 meters, it missed me by 3 inches. Just think about the math on that. Every guy up there had that, some experience like that, at least once, if not many times. The boys are up there for a year. They got back. Some of them got out of the Army and had tremendous psychological problems when they got home. Some of them stayed in the Army and were more or less okay psychologically. I was particularly close to a guy named Brendan O'Byrne. I'm still very good friends with him. He came back to the States. He got out of the Army. I had a dinner party one night. I invited him. And he started talking with a woman, one of my friends. And she knew how bad it had been out there. And she said, "Brendan, is there anything at all that you miss about being out in Afghanistan, about the war?" And he thought about it for quite a long time. He finally said, "Ma'am, I miss almost all of it." And he's one of the most traumatized people I've seen from that war. "Ma'am, I miss almost all of it." What is he talking about? He's not a psychopath. He doesn't miss killing people. He's not crazy. He doesn't miss getting shot at, seeing his friends get killed. What is it that he misses? We have to answer that. If we're going to stop war, we have to answer that question. I think what he missed is brotherhood. He missed, in some ways, the opposite of killing. What he missed was connection to the other men he was with. Now, brotherhood's different from friendship. Friendship happens in society, obviously. The more you like someone, the more you'd be willing to do for them. Brotherhood has nothing to do with how you feel about the other person. It's a mutual agreement in a group that you will put the welfare of the group, you will put the safety of everyone in the group above your own. In effect, you're saying, "I love these other people more than I love myself." Brennan was a team leader in command of three men. And the worst day in Afghanistan, he was almost killed so many times. Didn't bother him. The worst thing that happened to him in Afghanistan was one of his men was hit in the head with a bullet in the helmet. Knocked him over. They thought he was dead. He was in the middle of a huge firefight. No one could deal with it. And a minute later, Kyle Steiner sat back up from the dead, as it were, because he'd come back to consciousness. The bullet had just knocked him out. It glanced off the helmet. He remembers people saying, as he was sort of half conscious, he remembers people saying, "Steiner's been hit in the head. Steiner's dead." And he was thinking, "I'm not dead." And he sat up. And Brendan realized after that he could not protect his men. And that was the only time he cried in Afghanistan, was realizing that. That's brotherhood. This wasn't invented recently. Many of you have probably read the Iliad. Achilles surely would have risked his life or given his life to save his friend Patroclus. In World War II, there are many stories of wounded soldiers who were wounded, who were brought to a rear base hospital, who went AWOL, crawled out of windows, slipped out of doors, went AWOL, wounded, to make their way back to the front lines to rejoin their brothers out there. So you think about Brendan, you think about all of these soldiers, having an experience like that, a bond like that, in a small group, where they loved 20 other people, in some ways more than they loved themselves. You think about how good that would feel. Imagine it. And they are blessed with that experience for a year. And then they come home and they are just back in society like the rest of us are, not knowing who they can count on, not knowing who loves them, who they can love, not knowing exactly what anyone they know would do for them if it came down to it. That is terrifying. Compared to that, war psychologically in some ways is easy compared to that kind of alienation. That's why they miss it. And that's what we have to understand and in some ways fix in our society. Thank you very much.
That was Sebastian Younger, recorded at TED in January 2014. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4.
Cause I believe if you give a little bit of a little bit of love has got to come your way. I believe if you give a little bit of love to those you live with, a little bit of love has got to come your way.
And that was Rolf Nagenfein with his song, Little Bit of Love. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Stay tuned for Riot Act Radio and more non-traditional independent programming. Party 93.4 is a project of the Freeform Radio Initiative. A nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide diverse and innovative online broadcasting that reflects the interests and concerns of the community. If you like the program you've been listening to, please consider supporting the Freeform Radio Initiative by making a tax-deductible donation. You can go to the website at freeformradio.org or party934.com and click on the Donate button. Thanks in advance for your support. You can also sign up for our e-newsletter by going to party934.com and filling in the entry field with your email address. It's that simple. This is Panangara, your mixologist for Barkata Circle and storytelling for nonprofits. Thank you once again for listening. I'd like to close out our program with a title cut from the album of Rolf Nagenfein entitled Chicago, now available on iTunes. Hope you enjoyed today's featured artist and his music. Till next time, discover how telling your story will spark another story from someone across the table or across the globe, so you can make meaningful connections, foster understanding, and bring about real change in people's lives. Happy Fourth!
Not a firework in the sky, like the third day of July. I was flying much too high to ever come back down. It's not what you take with you, it's the baggage that you claim. When there's ghosts all around you and your friends are acting strange, if I speak any louder than I'll scream, I guess that all we have are memories, like those nights out on Lakeshore Drive, Lake Michigan, on one side and the radio up as loud as it can go. We race the ill train down the track, sail to the moon and back. I know it's not the way it goes, Chicago. Remember when the snow came, we burned low like twin flames. But you think love's a child's game, but you can't win. even if it was a goddamn lie. I had never been so fucking high as those nights out on Lakeshore Drive, Lake Michigan, on one side and a radio up as loud as it can go. Race the L train down the track, sail to the moon and back, but I know it's not the way it goes. Chicago. And you tried your best to break me, all you left's a crack. You don't know this time I'll be back to those nights out on Lakeshore Drive, Lake Michigan, on one side and a radio up, loud as it can go. And maybe this year the Cubs will win, maybe I'll be back. I go Chicago.